to enter the Elf Tree.
Are you receiving my transmission, or am I speaking to myself? Good. Welcome to the undisclosed location of nowhere. We broadcast for you.
You know that there, I was at Simon Phillips yesterday, the drummer, and he was had his drum set up, and he had a microphone in his bass drum.
Yeah.
And he also had a speaker that far away, a quarter of an inch away from his bass drum that was wired up.
A speaker next to his bass drum?
A speaker is the same thing as a microphone.
It's a diaphragm that vibrates
and
all that, right?
It's a diaphragm that vibrates.
Yeah.
And it's for the ultra low sounds. It only records. He explained it. I mean, the ones that you're only your body feel. You can't hear them.
So he put a speaker there in order to record those. So the speaker, rather than being an output, is an input.
And inside
of
each
bass. Wow, I didn't know you could do that.
Inside of each bass drum, he had a paint can, a gallon paint can, sitting on a towel or a piece of rubber or something, and it was filled with water.
In his bass drum,
which is the same density as sand, so it could be water or sand. And he told me who told him to do this, but it also changes the sound and resonance of the bass drum to give it this amazing whomp sound.
Well, yeah, it's all of a sudden all of this sound and these sound waves have to travel through something incredibly dense, the paint can with the well, but what if it had paint in it? How's that density?
Well, if it fell over, it'd make a mess. But
what if it was Jell-O? Like a paint can full of Jell-O?
Well, that would be the echo effect.
The echo effect?
Yeah, the wiggly.
That would be if you wanted it to, like, twist its neck around, you know, the Jell-O.
We're going to 1, 2.
That's Count Von Count?
No, that's actually Lawrence Welk. Well, 1, 2. We're going to play a good song right now.
It was on PBS back in the day.
No, he was on major network.
Oh, was he not?
Saturday nights.
Maybe they rerun it on PBS now.
Oh, gosh.
Okay.
Yeah, he was from the old country. And they had people that danced in big skirts, and they had a big
orchestra. Where is that on a map?
The old country?
Yeah. Put
it somewhere near. It's somewhere over near
Newsburg.
Romania.
Oh, okay.
In there. It's a little tiny country.
The old country?
Yeah.
It's just called old?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a small word.
It's on the map?
3 letters.
So, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
I want to introduce my dad, everybody. This is Larry McNinney. Say hi.
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 I want you to meet my son. This is Ian McNinney.
I'm Ian. Hi.
People get us mixed up all the time.
They do. Dad is obviously my dad, and he's here in California visiting me, and he's got some pretty amazing stories, most of which I've heard before. But today I'm here to talk to you about like your inspirations and stuff like that, the things that actually got you into what it is that you're doing or what it is that you did with your life and in some ways keep going and keep doing with your life in varying different forms.
Well, what got me in here today was you opened the front door.
You drove your car and we walked.
And I came in here and this is all set up and I'm...
It was. And suddenly we're recording.
I feel like I'm at KVIL radio in the 60s.
KIAN, Dad.
Hey, everybody. Come on, Dad. We're going to play some top 40 hits for you right now.
Sorry.
And then that's all the top 40 hits we have right now are the Hyde Air theme song, the Millie McCormick theme song, Monkey Shoulder theme song. That's about it.
Monkey Shoulder. That's good.
And the Atrium, the We2D2 theme song.
I like Monkey Shoulder. That's a good...
Monkey Shoulder is a good one. I'll let you hear that at the end of the episode.
All right.
So where do you come from? You come from Dallas. I know this.
I
know
was born and raised in Dallas. I'm one of the only original Dallasites that is from Dallas.
Ever?
I meet people in Dallas, and there are not too many of them that were born there. There's a famous...
What happened to them?
Bumper sticker. It says... I wasn't born in Texas, but I got here as fast as I could.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much it. But I was one of the original ones. I founded.
Well, where did everybody go?
I founded the city of Dallas with John Neely
with
Bryan.
With Billy Bob Dallas?
With John Neely Bryan and a bunch of other people.
Okay. Where do you think everybody else went? Roy City.
Well, they most of them died.
Wiley.
Yeah, most of them. No, they're still there. You know, there's a lot of them there, but excuse me.
You actually went out and did something and still called Dallas home. For the most part.
Yeah. I lived away for many years, for say 15 years, regularly. But
what do you mean regularly?
Well, I mean I didn't have a home in Dallas at all for 15 to 20 years, and then I came back.
Really?
Uh huh.
I didn't know this.
I left my early 20s.
You were born and raised here. No, not here, because we're in California. You were born and raised in Dallas.
I was born and raised in Dallas, and then I was in a band. And then when we...
Wait, whoa.
Did I jump?
Yeah. You're just
did I skip 20 years?
I was born, and suddenly I'm 18. No.
I was born and raised in Dallas. I went to school. I did the YMCA.
Come up a little closer.
I did the YMCA and Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts, and I played intramural football and
So in stark contrast to Mom, you didn't do a whole lot of living elsewhere and traveling and kind of loaning it when you were a kid growing up.
No, I mean, Dallas was like living in Oz. It was just, it was wonderful.
My dad, everybody, cannot resist the urge to make jokes from time to time.
It's not a joke.
So you might hear me asking him multiple questions a number of different times before we get a real question.
I mean, where else can you live when three tornadoes coming at your house?
Really?
And you survive.
When did this happen?
1957. Look it up. The Dallas tornadoes, 1957.
Where were you?
I was in the front yard of the house playing football with some friends, and my mom said, "Get in the house. There's tornadoes coming."
Wow. Like, and did they come? I mean, the house obviously was still there, so they didn't land on top of you.
No, some places got hit, but I remember we hit in the hallway with a mattress over us, my friends and brother and I.
Did it just fall over?
No, we pulled it off. My mom pulled it off of bed. And we were under there, and she said, "I'm going to go wait for your dad to come home," because he was at work and he was on his way home.
So she went out on the patio with a mini.
She went out in the driveway, and we were under there going, "Oh no, we're all dead. You know, we're going to die.
Right.
I'm 7 years old, and my life flashes
this
before
is it.
My eyes. You know, it was real fast."
But Goonies. Oh well, the Goonies wasn't even out yet. I was going to say Goonies lived longer than you did.
And then after about 15 minutes of sitting there underneath the mattress and smelling everybody's stinky feet, we thought, well, what's going on?
You just started hearing the munchkins outside.
We got up and we kind of crept out towards the back, and there were my mom and dad.
And suddenly everything was in color.
Standing there on the driveway, and I don't know, it seemed like 400 or 500 feet away, but it might have been a quarter of a mile away, was one of the tornadoes.
Mm.
It had lifted up off the ground and was kind of going north past the house.
So it wasn't on the ground anymore?
Not anymore, at that point, no.
And that was round about what area?
It was around the area when I was hoping it would pick my brother up and take him with us. No, it was North Dallas, Preston Road, Royal Lane.
Is that
Lane.
Where the tornado was kind of...
Yeah, that's where one of them went. The other two, I don't know. I mean, I think they probably got mugged somewhere down off Fitzhugh or something.
The tornadoes?
Like that.
Yeah, they went down to Harry Hines and conducted some business.
But I did that. I grew up there. I was in Boy Scouts.
And you're the middle child. Are you the typical middle child?
No, I'm not typical anything.
He's not.
No. Went to church there.
Wait a minute.
Went to grade school.
Wait a minute. What about the middle child thing? What was it like being the middle child?
Well, I got everything after it was used, but I didn't get everything before it was all used
up. Before it was used.
That was Rusty. That was my younger brother.
Wow.
You know. But we would get a popsicle, and I would get, like, the second lick, and Rusty would get the third lick, and, you know, it went like that.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
It's like the owl from the Tootsie Pop commercials.
Yeah, that's right. That's
one,
right.
One, two, three. That's what Rusty would do.
Yep. So we...
Eat that last popsicle.
We did that, and I had a pretty normal lifestyle. I mean, back then... Because
this was the 1950s and early 60s that you grew up.
Yeah, right. Sorry about that. It was a long time ago.
Well, it's all right. People
well,
age.
And but it was a more innocent time. I mean, we would actually in the summer get up, put on cutoffs, no shirt,
Daisy
barefoot,
Dukes.
And leave the house after excuse me, some breakfast of some kind, And we would be gone all day.
Yeah.
Maybe stop in for lunch, you know, and have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Yeah.
And then be gone until dinner time, you know. And mom and dad, no, the parents didn't worry about
the,
they didn't worry about the kids, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, we were smoking corn cob pipes and, you know, baling hay and all.
No, why washing fences?
Actually, it was a middle-class neighborhood. My dad built the house we grew up in. It was a residential neighborhood. He was a builder.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It wasn't like he built them.
Well,
all
no,
home.
I know. I was actually laughing at the corn cob pipe thing because all of a sudden I kind of got the what you were saying, the whole difference in lifestyle. We weren't living in Tom Sawyer times. That's what you're getting at.
I wasn't. No, I wasn't.
You thought you were.
Well, I did. I did actually try to convince some people to paint the picket fence white, but we didn't have
your
a picket
house?
Fence.
Yeah. Oh, right. I was going to say.
You know.
You had a brick fence.
We used to ride around on riding lawnmowers, the neighborhood. We'd get on them and...
They were called goats.
And we'd ride around the neighborhood all over.
You just
had a goat
joy cart. Ride on the lawnmower?
Yeah. Down the street, you'd raise up the blade so it wouldn't cut the cement or whatever. Well, and we'd take off and go to...
Well, that sounds dangerous.
It was fun, though.
But, I mean, you're, like, lifting up the blade so that it's...
Well, no, they come up, you know, so you can turn
But not
around.
Like, you're talking not like the industrial ones where they raise up vertically and the blade's just there.
We didn't have licenses to drive at that time.
Well, I know that. I'm not talking about... But, I mean, it might have been a little lawnmower.
We couldn't afford
lawnmower.
A big tractor like that.
It might have been a little lawnmower with those little things. Yeah. But it's still little blades and stuff.
Some of the guy's parents'
oh, okay.
lawnmowers, riding lawnmowers.
Well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we did that, and... growing up was great. I mean, I had a good life and
typical 50s American.
My parents tried to have me committed two or three times, but I avoided that. We made it through.
You kept getting distracted.
That's right. Well, I would distract them. I would, you know, say, look, there's a fire, and they would go see the fire and forget about having me committed.
But then what they didn't know is that you set the fire while you were trying to steal the Mustang.
My mom's still alive.
Well, that's true. She won't hear this, though.
Yeah.
She might. She might hear this.
Then I went to normal high school. I wasn't a great student. I was a good BC student.
BC?
Yeah, before college.
Christ. Oh, before college, yeah, yeah.
I was really more interested with what was going on outside the windows as opposed to inside the classroom.
Well, sure. Absolutely.
My mind was kind of more creative. I really didn't like history. I didn't like memorizing those dates and all that. I did have a teacher that was really good, and she told us everything about the test before the test. She went over the verbally in the classroom, and
well,
then
yes.
she'd pass out the test.
That's called teaching.
And everybody made really good grades, but I ended up learning more in that class and remembering more than I did.
What class was that?
Civics. Miss Broenkamp was her name.
Oh.
I remember her in high school. I went to high school, grade school, junior high, and high school, all within about a mile of each other.
Really?
All within about a mile of our house.
Well, that's the way it was supposed to be back in the day.
Yeah.
That's the way it's still supposed to be.
And then when I was about 13, I played football and stuff and intramural and stuff in the front yard with kids and all. Then I got stomped into the bushes one day, and I didn't like that. You know, in the mud, my face was smushed into the mud. You know, we were playing Tupelo. You're supposed to touch Tupelo the waist.
Yeah,
and you're,
yeah.
Well, this wasn't that.
Touch football.
No, it was straight down to the ground. And I realized that that's nothing I really liked, you know.
No.
I didn't want to keep doing that. So a friend of mine had a guitar. He showed me once.
Play kickball. Whenever I was in public school, we would play kickball. And that was, it was always a fun game, but it was never fun to play with all these kids because all they cared about was winning and having the best team and the best score and all that kind of stuff. I didn't care.
Yeah.
I just wanted to play kickball. I just wanted to kick that ball as hard as I could.
I was never on a team that won we'd never won many games. You know, baseball team, we'd win a game out of 12. You know?
Well, that's better than me. When I was in that basketball team, you remember how many games we won?
Well, I think
over 2 years.
Yeah, you probably lost.
Not a one. We did not win a single game.
But see, what that was a great record.
Well, I guess we were 0-28 and 1 because we tied one game.
But you probably got pizza after every game.
I don't remember. I don't remember if we did or not. You would. You guys would remember more than I would.
I don't. Yeah, but no, I don't know. I was probably drunk all the time. No, I wasn't. But the friend pulled out a guitar from under his bed, and his parents had bought it for him at a pawn shop.
Yeah.
And it was red sparkle. And
nice.
It had like 14 or 15 buttons on it. Toggle buttons
did?
And switches and mirrors and...
And a Fisher-Price logo on top of it.
I mean, it was one of those guitars that you see in an old-fashioned pawn shop that you go, wow, what is that?
Really?
And the strings were about 2 inches above the neck. So, it was really...
Weird?
But I thought it was pretty cool, you know?
Yeah.
And so, he played a couple of things. He wasn't very good on it. And I convinced my parents that I really wanted to learn to play guitar. And they bought me a Silvertone guitar, came in a case from Sears. I was 13.
Okay.
The case, there was a little amplifier built into the case with a speaker that faced the front and the guitar. And you open up, take the guitar out, stand the case up, plug the guitar into the amp in the case.
Oh, wow.
And you'd play.
Yeah.
Cost $68.
Which is equivalent to what, 250 here now? Something like that. I mean, seriously.
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. If it's a decent quality.
It was a Silvertone. They're collector's items now.
Yeah.
But the fret, the strings were too high off the fret, which I tried to fix because you can't. I mean, every time you would play, you'd have bloody tips of your fingers from pressing so hard. And I ended up taking some lessons. Learning how to play some chords, learning how to play bar chords. I really didn't like playing, Down by the Bay. I really didn't like playing Turkey in the Straw or some of the old folk songs. I can't even remember them right now.
Dixie.
Because that's what these guys were going to teach you how to play. Down in the valley.
Well, yeah, I guess old
the
school.
Excuse me, I'm singing. The valley so long. Anyways.
So I get my lighter out.
I saved up my money and bought a better guitar.
Yeah.
Found a new teacher that taught me.
What was that guitar? This is the first guitar you ever bought for yourself. What guitar was it?
It was a Stratocaster, $330.
Nice.
But I saved up money from my paper route.
And this is like 1964.
The Dallas Morning News.
Oh, I mean, Dad is notorious for telling everybody the Dallas Morning News story. So you have to. Hey, we make a joke in our family that hi, Larry McNenny, nice to meet you. Do you know I used to throw the Dallas Morning News? it's funny. So I think you should regale the whole world with just the Cliff Notes version of this tale.
It's all a lie. I never threw the Dallas Morning News.
Ever?
No.
Really?
That's right.
No,
I used to rob places.
He used to rob the Dallas Morning News.
That's right.
He used to go behind the guy who threw the Dallas Morning News and go and pick up
the
papers.
I'd pick them up and throw them to people's houses that didn't subscribe.
Yeah, he'd give them to the homeless.
But I made enough money to buy a guitar, a good guitar, and Fender was one of the top brands. This is 1964-ish, and found a guy to teach me lessons that my mom would take me to at McCord Music in Dallas, and he taught me a few bar chords and a couple of other things, and I figured, well, I've learned enough now, I'll go up my own way.
I'm 15 now, I can do this.
Yeah, well, I know four bar chords, I know how to do this, you know.
Gosh.
And so I did that, and then I was sitting in...
But did you like it?
Oh, I love playing the guitar.
But you just didn't
like
learning.
I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, as most aspiring rock stars did. And you see all the girls screaming, and you go, well, that sure looks a lot more fun than laying in the mud with some football player standing on your head.
Right,
so
doesn't it?
That's what I did. And
so it was all about the ladies.
Well, I thought so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if I'd have practiced more, I might have been a better guitar player.
Well, if you'd taken lessons till you were 16,
that's right.
You might have been up there.
But I was sitting in home in study hall once in junior high. And this guy in front of me was annoying me or something like that. And we ended up talking, and he said he was a drummer. And I said, oh, really? How long have you been playing?
This guy ended up annoying you, and you ended up talking?
Yeah, well, something, you know, something.
Yeah, yeah.
You had to slap him upside the head.
Wow.
And he said, I've been playing drums for, you know, 2 or 3 years now, you know. I mean, he's 13 or 14, too.
I'm hot stuff.
And he said, well, I play guitar. Well, he said, how long are you playing? I said, oh, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, you know.
Really said
that? We both lied to each other. So we decided we were going to put a band together.
Nice. And the guy's name was? You could bring it up.
Oh, he's Larry Melidio.
Larry Melidio.
Yeah.
It's ironic. These two 14-year-old kids.
Both named Larry.
With the unfortunate adult name Larry.
That's right.
As 14-year-old. I mean, come on. Do you grew up as Larry? You didn't think people were like, that's a little kid. That name is just a little. You don't think that's a little bit of a... It'd be like naming a little girl Ethel.
It could have been Otis.
You know, cute little 4-year-old baby girl Ethel. I mean, I'm not saying it's a bad name.
It could have been Hershey Bar.
They could have named you Hershey Bar?
Yeah, but...
They could have named you Orangelo.
Well...
Or Lamangelo.
You smile when you say that. Well, anyhow.
So you started a band.
And then we decided to start a band. We needed somebody else. So we found a guy who played.
Otherwise,
actually,
it's just 4 bar chords and a snare drum. Well,
we found a guy who actually played guitar and could sing, John Andrew Parks, Andy Parks.
Really?
And we had a band. We started rehearsing.
I've heard that name a lot.
Yeah.
I didn't know that's who this was.
He's an incredible songwriter.
So you were in a band with him.
Yeah.
I didn't know this. These are all the things that, like, I get a lot of these big stories out of you, and then there are just these.
Trust me, it's not that big.
Well, I mean, it's a story that I've heard most of my life, and then suddenly there's that tiny little detail, and I'm like, oh, I just thought you just knew.
If any of you are listening out there, look up, Google John Andrew Parks and listen to some of his songs. He's great.
He's got some great music.
But we did. We were called the Corsairs because he had a model Corsair airplane.
Like a plastic model?
Yeah, you know, those were World War II airplanes.
Yeah, yeah. And, I didn't know that, but...
And we played mostly Roy Orbison songs.
Like what?
Pretty Woman.
Okay.
Well, and... oh, gosh.
Because it had the 4 bar chords?
Well, no, just that, because that's what Andy could sing, and he was really good.
Okay.
And we actually played at some parties. We play on people's patios, you know, for like $6. You know, if their kids would have a little dance party, we'd go play and, you know, do that stuff. That was the time Duke of Earl came out. Duke of Earl. That was the biggest song going on a record at the time.
Hmm.
Many people out there will never have heard of that. But
well, but they can go and check it out on
Duke
iTunes.
Duke of Earl, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So that went on from there, and I, you know, went through a lot of bands playing in the clubs in Dallas and around. We actually played fraternity parties in Austin. And
do you play in any clubs that are still around today?
Gosh.
Do you ever play at the Gypsy Tea Room, Trees?
Well, no, the Cellar's gone, the Studio Club, the Saracen in Austin. The Catacombs, the Purple Onion, in Wichita Falls. I mean, we played a lot of fraternity parties. There's fraternities that are still around, but I can't. Those all have Greek names, and I don't.
It's all Greek to me.
We would play anywhere that they would pay us. I learned that white guys don't dance very well.
No,
95% of them. Most other males can dance. Most women can dance really well. And because we were always up playing.
I think most women just look good doing whatever they call dancing because guys are the ones looking at them.
Yeah, well, and the guys are the ones looking real stupid.
Right, because they're too busy looking at the girls.
So I didn't date a lot in high school because we were always playing, excuse me, all the parties that people were going to. We played parties at the high school.
You know? Mom and dad started to get concerned that you would just cuddle up with your guitar every night.
Well, I did. I mean, I would write songs. The band would rehearse.
You'd end up buying a second movie ticket for your Stratocaster.
Hey, she was sweet.
You share a milkshake?
Well, she was high strung, but I did that mostly through my teenage years, and I should have been practicing and studying more, but I spent my time on the phone trying to get jobs for the band so we could make some money.
Yeah.
If we got a job out of town, we had to rent a truck or a van or a trailer to get there. And we had to, if it was Austin or somewhere like that, usually a lot of times we would have to get a hotel room to stay overnight. So we'd get some $24 a night hotel room, and all 4 or 5 of us would sleep in the hotel room in the beds together.
Wow.
That's just how you did it.
It's just what it is.
And
always throw a TV out the window at the end of it.
Yeah, but it was only 2 feet.
out
the window. No, but we did that, and a lot of other bands were a lot. Jimmy Vaughn was in a band called The Chessmen, and He's a well-known musician, blues player.
Related to Stevie Ray Vaughan.
He was Stevie's older brother.
Yeah.
And Stevie was used to hang around and Jimmy and all. But, you know, we played...
So you were you used to hang out with Stevie Ray Vaughan?
Well, no, I used to hang out... Jimmy and I hung out
Stevie Ray Vaughan used to come around and hang out with you guys.
Yeah.
And
we would play the circuit.
Wow. There was that's a little bit mind-blowing, though. I mean, you've... people don't even know the stories that are about to, you know, the people that you've met and everything like that. But that right there, I mean, Stevie Ray Vaughan was
pretty mind-blowing to me when all of a sudden we, you know, David Bowie comes out with an album in 1989 or something, and Stevie Ray Vaughan's the lead guitar on the album. And,
yeah.
And his career just skyrocketed from there, you know. So then I'd lost touch with him. I didn't know what he was doing, but he became this incredible talent. Jimmy's an incredible talent. And they chose to go a blues direction. I was more rock and roll stuff and more showy, theatrical.
Black Sabbath.
Not nearly as good a guitar player as they were.
Showy and theatrical. I mean, I've seen a bunch of pictures of some of your old band days where you've got all sorts of makeup and long hair and Fu Manchu and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, showy works. Showy, I mean, that fits.
Okay. I was kind of showy. Now it'd be called something else.
Now it would be called something else.
Yes, but we did that for a long time, and then at some point, after the couple of years of college, we all decided that we needed to move to Los Angeles. The band I was in, the four of us had been together for 3 or 4 years.
The same four of you?
The same four, and we had written all of our own music and were performing and. We didn't get to play in a lot. We did play...
Wait, who's the fourth? There's
Larry Melidio, Lanny Lander, and Jim McClellan, and myself.
Oh, now what happened to Andy Parks?
Oh, gosh. We, you know, bands changed, chopped and changed somebody. I mean, Andy and I, we had a band together for 4 or 5 months.
Yeah, yeah.
Then it was somebody else, and then it was somebody else.
You just kept in touch.
Yeah, I lost touch after high school and for 15 years or something. And we ran into each other in New York. He had a recording studio up in New York.
That's cool.
Recording Richie Havens and Marianne Faithful and a lot of other artists.
Nice.
And perfecting his talents.
Okay, so when you talk about the band, it's which one
really
are we talking
the band
about?
Was Melidio, Jim McClellan, and Lanny Lander.
And you.
And me. And Lanny
and
is
me.
Lanny's with Clare Brothers in Nashville.
Currently?
I think he's out with Garth Brooks right at the moment doing something on Garth's tour. He's not playing. He's not a musician. But
Okay, so you all, the four of you decided to move
out to
California.
We moved to Los Angeles.
And what was the name of the band? You've had a couple.
Well, we had, I think at that time we were called Flag, F-L-A-G-G. So we got to Los Angeles, and it was 71.
Okay.
And it was the heyday of the Continental Hyatt House, and Led Zeppelin were there, you know, were coming around. Alice Cooper just hit. Our singer was friends with Alice, so we knew him and some of his people. But great shows. Sunset Strip was cruising every night. I mean, it was just something. Our mode of transportation was a big U-Haul truck, because that's what we drove out there in, and we kept it for months and months on end. We disconnected the speedometer
the
cable. The odometer cable.
Yeah. So you stole mileage.
But
U-Haul's going to come after you.
But we decided we needed a new name. Flag was just kind of flag. You know, it was kind of, if there wasn't enough wind, it just kind of laid there.
There you go.
So we decided to call ourselves Big Punks.
Nice.
We wanted something edgy, and this was long before punk music, before Johnny Rotten, and before the New York Dolls and all of that.
Yeah.
And we played out here. A guy named Bob Eubanks wanted to manage us. Bob Eubanks was the host of the Newlywed Game.
Okay, yes, I've heard
that. He managed the Everly Brothers and a couple of other acts. A comedian named Kip Adada. I don't know what's happened to him. And so... we thought that was cool. We got a big opportunity here.
Yeah.
So we set up if they wanted to see us play, although they liked our stuff, they liked the tapes we did, but they wanted to see us live, so we set up something, or they set up something at a club. And we went and...
Not just a club. What club was it?
I can't remember. It was some club...
Where was
it? Off Santa Monica.
Okay.
Somewhere like that.
But Santa Monica's a big...
And it wasn't... there was no audience. It was
the people that worked in his office and yeah. all of that, and maybe a few others. It was in the afternoon, but we played, and the following Monday or the next day, we got a notice that, you know, they no longer wanted to manage us.
Oh, no.
Well, we were too theatrical for them and really? Too over the top for them. Yeah, I mean, it was...
Gosh.
We were, you know, we... The Who were my favorite band, so I mean, I really like Pete Townshend. He and I had known each other since I was about 15.
Yeah,
and I was more of that kind of a guitar player, and I liked
okay, yeah.
conceptual pieces. And we, it was kind of heavy metal music, but not thrash metal
yeah,
music. It
yeah.
was loud rock and roll, and we were good because we played a lot and we rehearsed every night.
Yeah.
If we weren't playing for somebody, performing for somebody, we rehearsed every night in a room behind my parents' house. God bless them.
Yeah.
We had egg cartons on the walls. And every night at 7 o'clock, everybody would show up and we would rehearse till about 10 or 10:30. Then we'd go out to some clubs and hang out and do what we did.
Hang out.
And then we'd come home, go to bed, and do it the next day, you know.
Yeah.
So we were really good. Our music... which we've got a lot of tapes of, is really tight. I mean, the people have listened to it and gone, man, you guys were great.
Do you have any of it anywhere online?
Oh, yes, but...
We'll post it on the website.
Well, there's stuff on YouTube.
We'll share it. We'll find it and share it.
There's stuff on YouTube.
You're going to be you'll have to
find it yourself.
You're going to become famous.
Well.
At 65.
Yeah, I'm not 65.
Sorry. Well, I know. That's next year. You know, give it a year.
56.
Yeah, 56. Okay, got it. Yeah. 22.
Anyway, so we did that. We lived out here. We got beat up once after leaving the Rainbow after an Alice Cooper concert.
The whole band?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We left. There was a party after the concert at the Hollywood Bowl.
I didn't know this.
Alice played Schools Out. It was the Schools Out tour.
Yeah.
We were invited as his guests and watched the show, and a helicopter flew down inside the Hollywood Bowl.
Wow.
And dropped 10,000 pairs of panties over the audience.
That's awkward.
Because the album, the record in the album had panties over the record.
Oh,
in,
yes.
In the sleeve.
Yes, okay.
And so after the concert, there was a party at the Rainbow.
Is that where you got it from? You used to put them on your head? What, did a pair land on your head and you're just reliving it?
That may have been.
It may have been.
I just didn't notice.
I'm like 4 years old, and my dad is most known for whenever he does laundry, he takes stuff out of the dryer and finds a pair of undies and instantly go on top of his head.
Those are male undies, so.
And well, that's true.
I don't know. Maybe.
But maybe that's what happened. What happened. You got traumatized by having ladies' undies on your head, so you're trying to erase it by putting all of your own men's undies on your head.
Mondays. We did that, and then we went to the Rainbow and didn't know many people. You know, Alice and all the people, they were busy, and we had a drink or two. We weren't drinkers or really thing. I mean, at 22 back then, you know.
But people know Alice Cooper, so you're just hanging out with Alice Cooper.
But back then, he was, you know, he was a big star, but our singer went to church with him in Phoenix and all that, so they knew each other.
Okay.
And they'd known each other 5 or 6 years or more at that time. Both of the fathers,
and
Alice's father and Jim's father, were deacons in the same church.
Okay. And so, he's about your age?
He's a couple of years older, I think.
Okay, but, I mean, yeah.
He's not as good looking, though.
Well, that's all the drugs.
Yeah, well, but he wears makeup. Oh, he hadn't done drugs in a long time. He's in great shape.
Yeah, now. Oh, well, good.
I'd like to see him again sometime. However, anyways.
Alice, come be on the show.
We left the Rainbow, and we had to go around back because we had our truck. You know, that was our mode of transportation. We had
your
to park
U-Haul
it.
Truck?
Our U-Haul truck. It was parked up behind Gazzari's, which is a famous club that's no longer there on Sunset.
Mm-hmm.
As we were walking up around to our truck, we realized three guys were following us.
Hmm.
And there were four of us.
Yeah.
And we were scared. I mean,
they were big guys.
Not necessarily, but they were on something.
Oh.
And one of them said, do you have...
What do you think they were on?
Do y'all have...
What do you think they were on?
Colfax or something.
No.
No.
You said you were on Sunset.
Well, they were doing some kind of something that made them awfully numb. Because they came up behind us and said, you guys got a cigarette? And I said, no, we don't smoke. And The other guys responded. And about that time, I saw one of them land a punch against the drummer's, Larry Melidio's, cheek.
Yeah.
And his head kind of went like that.
Like the Matrix.
Well, the first thing I did was
duck,
grabbed the keys and ran to the truck and got in as fast as I could.
Did you really?
The other three guys set about a fighting with the other three guys. I screamed, "Get in the truck!" And one by one, Lanny and Jim started getting in, fighting over towards the truck.
Well, that was the right answer.
Started fighting and getting over towards the truck. Lanny got in, and he was kicking somebody away and pulled the door shut. Jim got in, and we're all in. It's one bench seat in a,
What kind of? This is the U-Haul. Sorry, U-Haul truck. Yeah.
And Melidio was the last one in, and some guy was trying to punch him and Larry was kicking him in the head, and the guy wasn't doing it. I mean, the guy didn't feel it.
Yeah.
So that's how we knew that they were on something.
Wow.
I mean, he was still fighting, and Larry got in the truck behind the wheel. And pulled the door shut with the guy's hand in the door.
Ouch.
Numerous times.
Ouch.
And I mean, it was going bam, bam, bam. Finally, the guy fell to the ground.
Yeah.
We started the truck and backed out, and we were going, run over them, run over them.
Oh, no.
Well, we did,
he didn't run over them.
I can't go into that.
I can't divulge that information.
Yeah, no. And then we drove home. We were pretty nervous. We didn't move around for a couple of days. I mean, there were some swollen lips. I was fine.
Oh.
Because I got on the truck first.
Well, you were the getaway driver.
No, I wasn't even driving. I was just the getaway guy holding the keys.
The getaway idea, man. But you never knew why.
But on the way home
that night. Randomly.
On the way home that night, we lived in Cagle Canyon. We were going down some street, and there was some fella walking down the middle of the street.
Yeah.
Right at our truck. Holding up his hands, going, "Stop! Stop!" And we stopped, and he's standing there in front of our truck, and we realized that he was crazy too.
Oh, wow.
So we pulled around and.
You just had.
It was a bad night altogether.
Yeah, you just had a pretty bad night.
Yeah, so we were out here for a few months. We won numerous battles of the bands.
Yeah.
You'd win $200 at these clubs. There's a club called the Ice House in the Fox Theater down in Long Beach.
Yeah, yeah.
And we would win these battles of bands and get the money, and there was always a record contract that never materialized.
Right.
And we went back to Dallas because we needed more money. We worked.
And when was this?
Well, probably 72.
Okay. You've been out here a year.
Yeah. Well, we weren't quite, not quite a year.
Okay.
But we went back and we earned more money. We used to play up in Oklahoma a lot. We made a bunch of extra cash. I bought a bus I traded our Singer sewing machine van in and bought a 43-seater school bus.
Wow.
Chopped all the seats out.
Like a yellow school bus.
Yellow school bus. Chopped all the seats out, painted it blue. We used it a couple of times, but it had a really bad steering problem. If you hit a bump going under 30, the steering wheel would almost yank your arms off. It would start.
Oh, wow.
So we needed a little bit more money to go to Los Angeles to come back. So one day we carpeted the inside of the bus with some cheap carpet we found, painted the inside and built a couple of benches. And we ended up selling it to another band there in town for $1,100.
Oh, wow.
And we took that $1,100 and got out of Dodge as quick as we could.
Nice.
The next couple of weeks, they had to spend $2,500 having the front end of the bus rebuilt.
There you go. That's how you're supposed to do it.
So we came back out here.
Because it worked when you had it.
That's, well, yeah.
Ish.
We came back out here and we're performing our anti-satanic rock opera.
Colleges. Yeah.
We had written this conceptual piece and costumes and makeup and fire breathing. This is long before Kiss, or several years before Kiss and all that. Kabuki makeup and all that. And we performed at Loyola University and at some clubs.
Wow.
Loyola University filmed it. It was free to the students.
Really? Wait a minute. You can't just gloss over that. You just said that there's history, possible documentation of this rock opera.
They videotaped it.
Right.
But back then, videotape was fairly new, so it was like one inch tape or something.
Yeah, but there might be some archives.
No, because they would have, after two or three days, they had to erase it and record something else.
But why would they have recorded it?
Well, just to, so they could show it in one of their classes the next day.
Well, you know what? It might be worth asking.
I have. We have.
Did you? Okay. I mean, that would have been cool.
We have. It was Loyola out by north of the Los Angeles airport.
Okay.
It was fun, though. It was in the gymnasium, and there was costume changes, and we rented a casket from Universal Studios prop department. And
wow.
The finale of the show was...
This is all new. I didn't know any of this.
Finale of the show was we were playing at the last song, and we hit some chords, and there was a lot of feedback because I had like four Marshalls, and Lanny had four big bass amps.
Gosh.
And the drummer. And at that time... there was a lot of feedback going on, and the crowd is kind of, I don't know if they were enjoying it or not. They're probably going, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
but we filled the stage with smoke
from
a fog machine as much as we could, so we could no longer be seen.
Yeah.
we had previously recorded us playing the same feedback.
Oh, really?
On a tape recorder.
Nice.
And
oh, so the feedback is intentional.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Once we were covered by smoke, the guy, our sound man, turned on out front. He was a hippie we had picked up hitchhiking.
No way.
He was no sound man, really.
Do you remember his name?
Jay was his first name. He's the one that almost got me shot on the Ventura Freeway. That's another story.
Okay, I was going to ask if you had any trouble with the law.
Oh, yeah. But they turned on the feedback.
Yeah.
And it was the same feedback that we were doing, the same notes, the same tone.
Yeah, yeah.
And... we turned off, unplugged our guitars, and walked off the stage while this feedback's going on. So the audience thought we were still on stage.
Yeah.
And they turned the fog machines off, and the fog starts to lift, and there's all this noise coming out, and there's nobody on stage. Everybody's gone.
Wow.
So that was our big climax to the show.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And so where were you? Like, what size clubs were you playing when you played something like this?
Well, that was there were probably about 1,500 people there. But that wasn't a club. That was a gymnasium at the college. The clubs,
The
clubs we would play would be 200, maybe 150. The Ice House and all of that. I don't remember. Big bands were playing the Whiskey and the Troubadour and stuff. You know,
right.
Bands that had a record out. We didn't have a record out.
Right, right.
But,
and then, so then, I mean, kind of what happened? What transitioned into what you ended up doing from there?
Well, the band we lived in Canoga Park, and we had moved. We had moved to Simi Valley.
Simi,
which was Simi.
Yeah.
Touch me.
So Simi.
Feel me.
Yeah.
Simi. So we moved out there, and we had the roadies and some other people move in with us, and it got to be too much.
Really.
Too many people and too many girlfriends and stuff hanging out. And we really got distracted from our purpose.
Yeah.
And one night we came home and there was a dog and he chewed up Larry Melidio's shoe.
Oh, wow.
One day while we weren't there. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And he quit. No, for Larry. And Larry quit, said, I'm going back home to Dallas. He said,
because the dog ate his shoe?
Well, it was tough. Money was thin. You know, we were working hard. You know, we need a lot of...
If all you've got is that one shoe.
We need a lot of baked potatoes.
Oh, wow.
make cheap sangria.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And...
you have to do what you have to do every once in a while.
Well, and so he and Jim both left. The singer decided he was going back to Dallas.
Yeah.
I stayed out here for a little while. Lanny stayed out here for longer. He married a girl from out here. I went back eventually.
Yeah.
And then Jim came back out here, actually, and joined another band called Axecraft that didn't do anything at the time.
Yeah.
Melidio stayed in Dallas and has several patents to his name, is in the bus business, has a recording studio and all. We see each other every once in a while. But
that's awesome.
That's kind of the end of that. And I went through a year of going, now what the heck am I going to do?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'd played with these same guys. I wasn't a blues player.
And you're how old at this point?
I was 52. No,
gosh.
No, I was 22, 23.
Okay.
And I didn't know, you know, what to do. I wasn't the kind of guitar player that could just go sit in and jam with anybody.
Right.
You know, because for the last 3 or 4 years, all I'd done was play our own songs that we wrote. I mean, I knew how to play some copies, Stones and Beatles stuff and all that. But so I thought, well, I was the one who did all the booking and rented the truck and got the hotel and all of that. Maybe I can get into the business side of it.
Yeah.
So I kind of started trying to figure out how to do that and focus on that. But, you know, in the meantime, before I had any success with that, I auditioned for Iggy Pop. He was putting his band together.
Wow. And so...
Wow. Here in Hollywood.
Gosh.
It was an experience. The audition took place at one of the Doors' house. Ray Manzarek, or one of the guys that used to be in the Doors.
Goodness.
And this is after Jim Morrison had died.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly. And then I didn't get that job. then I auditioned for
one tier.
Ruby Starr. Out of Macon, Georgia, there was we had the Allman Brothers. Then you had, there were a couple of other, Wet Willie was another band.
Gosh.
There were a couple of others. And it was Southern Rock, you know, but Macon, Georgia, they had a record company called Capricorn Records. Phil Walden, I think, was his name. But they put together Ruby Starr, that was her stage name, was a backup singer for one of the bands. They did Black Oak, Arkansas, or something. No, that was Butch Stone. That was another. But anyway, so they were auditioning for a guitar player, and I thought, So I drove from Tulsa. I was living up in Oklahoma at the time, all the way to Macon, Georgia.
Wow.
With my Marshall single cabinet in the back to audition for about 30 minutes.
And then drove back. How long was the drive?
A long way.
Wow.
By myself, and I didn't get the gig. Because I really didn't. Like I said, I wasn't the kind of guitar player that could go sit in and do it. I tried.
You needed to have your own.
Yeah, I was...
your own band.
Yeah, who wouldn't fire me?
Well, sure.
Because I wasn't good enough.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's how I feel sometimes.
We didn't fire you. You're still our son.
I know that. No.
No, we did that. I did that, and then...
I don't know that I could go and just write with anybody, you know, make movies or, you know, work on TV shows or anything like that. I don't think that I could just do that and jump on the bandwagon of, you know, making the same kind of movies that everybody else kind of makes and everything.
But I almost have to now. I mean, with writers and films, I mean, if somebody came to me and said, that's a great idea for a TV show. Can you write with these four other guys? I'd say, you bet.
What I mean is that would be your idea and you'd be doing it like that. I couldn't just jump on as, you know, answer a want ad on Craigslist for somebody to come in and help write this cheesy slasher horror movie. You know, I mean,
If they've got money to produce it, I bet you could.
I just couldn't. I couldn't do it because my heart and soul wouldn't be into
it. That's your youth speaking.
But you just said that
I didn't say that youth was smart.
But you know what? I don't think that we have to anymore. You know, I mean, I think we live in an era where anything that we want to do, like what I'm doing right here, I'm literally just putting in a microphone in front of us and recording it, and we'll release it. And that'll be my way of getting some stuff out there. I think that there are avenues out there for more people to get the stuff that they want, the way that they want it out there and get people to have the opportunity to hear it and latch on than there were back in the day.
Well, that's because of digital technology.
It is. And the internet.
Digital technology is great, but it ruined the entertainment business. It ruined the record business.
Well, yes, sure.
I mean, in as much as it...
selfishness
it diluted it so much.
Yeah.
It's great that you can go in and record a lot cheaper now that everybody can record. But, I mean, there's, you know, how many CDs are released every day? But privately, publicly, whatever. And songwriters and all that. It's great. There are good parts and bad parts. But the songwriter thing is horrible, that nobody's making any money writing songs anymore.
No, people are making money writing songs that have lyrics like "bounce your booty everywhere" and all that kind of stuff. I mean,
but they're not making much. They're getting it all on Rhapsody and Spotify, and they're making nothing.
Well, I guess you're right.
They're performing live. That's how they're making money. In the old days,
touring and merchandise,
you could make as much money as you could touring writing a song. I mean, that's why
Steely Dan, I don't know the real story behind why they didn't tour very much, but they made fortunes just recording albums. They were great players, wrote great songs, but they never went out on the road.
Yeah.
Very seldom, if so.
Well, back in the day, I guess you didn't have to, like you just said.
They didn't, but most bands did. I mean, yeah. You did to sell records. You couldn't go. In Europe, you would do it. You would tour to sell records. You couldn't make any money because the venues weren't big enough.
Right.
There were a couple in England you could do. There were a couple in, one in Paris, one in maybe a couple in Germany you could make some money at. But the rest of them were old theaters and 2,000 seats, if that, and you'd break even.
Yeah.
But it would sell a lot of records. Nowadays, gotcha. In Europe, there's a lot of 10, 12, 20,000 seat, venues.
Yeah.
You could make a lot. You'd tour America to make money in playing,
to make money to
arenas.
Go and tour Europe.
To make money, and you'd sell records, but you would also make money from the shows.
Right.
Germany, you could make a little bit of money, but then Japan and all of that came into it, and it grew.
Yeah.
But I was really fortunate to bump into somebody who knew somebody that went to play with Eric Clapton. On 461 Ocean Boulevard. I was living in Tulsa trying to, figure out what to do for a year and a half or 2 years, and knowing this was going on behind the scenes and trying to meet people. And I knew some of the guys in the band, and they would go off for 4 or 5 months and record and come back. And I was working in this office that Carl Radel, the bass player, funded.
Yeah.
He had a guy that was taking care of his business and a secretary that would, write the checks and pay for his house and his electric bill while he was traveling.
Yeah.
And one day I was sitting there and the phone rang, and Julie picked up the phone and said, "Larry, there's Carl's on the phone for you." And I went, "Oh, well, I knew Carl and knew he knew me." But I said, "Well, what does he want with me? He's down in Dallas rehearsing for a tour with Eric."
Yeah.
This was 76, I believe. And he said, I got on the phone and he said, "How would you like to come go to work for Eric? And Roger, Eric's manager, needs an assistant."
Oh, wow. So you just got the call randomly?
Out of the blue.
And
he said, "Can you get on a plane in 2 hours to come to Dallas?" Well, that was my home.
How old are you?
I was 26 at the time.
Okay. So,
1976.
So you've been, the band had been kind of done for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. I mean, there was some years of wandering.
You found your way.
Like Tom Hanks, I ran across America 3 times,
with a volleyball.
Oh, yeah.
That's another Tom Hanks, Yeah. It's a good one. And a dog named Hooch.
Yeah. me and you and a dog named Hooch. Sounds like a song.
Me, you, and Dupree.
Anyway, so I did that, and that's how I got into touring.
So this is a guy that you knew of.
I knew Carl.
You kind of worked with him.
Carl had played with Gary Lewis and the Playboys.
Right.
Carl had played with Delaney and Bonnie and Friends. He had played with Derek and the Dominoes. So he knew Eric. And Eric had since, after that, gone on to his Patty period where he and Patty and George Harrison, swapped around, and Patty ended up with Eric. But Eric had gone through a period of drugs and all, and not doing anything, not performing, not recording. And when he finally won Patty and she got him, things got straight, he wanted to go back out, and he called Carl up.
Yeah.
Knowing that Carl was a good, reliable bass player, well-respected, and a good guy.
Yeah.
And said, "Put me together some guys. I hear there's some great players in Tulsa, and meet me in Miami in a few weeks, and we're going to record." So they went to Criteria Recording Studio and recorded 461 Ocean Boulevard, which is his comeback album.
Yeah.
With Carl Radel, Dick Sims, Jamie Oldacre, George Terry, Marcy Levy, as a backup singer, and Yvonne Elliman, who played Mary Magdalene in Jesus Christ Superstar.
Wow.
And they were all, it was on RSO Records, Robert Stigwood.
Yeah.
At the time, that's another long story, how that all came about.
Wow.
The Stigwood era.
Absolutely.
But they had done a tour of America and Europe, or short dates. And Eric was quite known at the time for playing with his back to the audience, because he really kind of wasn't ready to be out there in the front. He really always wanted to, evidently, wanted to be a background player for a band.
Wow.
Which he did in the Yardbirds and a lot of in Delaney and Bonnie and all those bands.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden he kept getting thrust into the forefront.
Well,
which I wasn't what he had planned at all.
No, but I mean, legends very rarely or ever seeking legendary status.
So, I mean, you know, so he would, at these first few tours, I mean, sometimes he would actually play the whole show with his back to the audience.
Gosh.
You know.
Wow. Okay. So this is like 1976.
Yeah.
And well,
75 is when they did 461.
Okay.
And I joined in 76.
And this is when they're getting ready to go out on tour for this album?
It's the same album was out. They hadn't recorded a new album.
Yeah.
But they were doing a tour from, they rehearsed in Dallas, and then we started in Miami and worked our way across the southern part of America. And we did a tour. We hit a lot of cities. to me, I mean, I'm a young 26-year-old, and Eric Clapton was in Cream and all of this. I knew who he was, so every night it was just great. I'm getting listened to this music. I'm traveling with the band. I'm not a roadie setting up the amps and all of that.
Right. So you're an assistant to the manager.
Yeah. The crew worked a whole lot harder than I did. My job wasn't easy by any means, but they worked physically a whole lot harder.
Well, people like you are the brains of and just kind of the blueprints of it all.
I wouldn't say that in front of any crew member.
Well, but what I mean is you got to be able to figure it out, and they are the people.
I was
I
was good at seeing the bigger picture and seeing how things did, as the production managers do nowadays. Production managers run tours nowadays, not tour managers.
Well,
it used to be the other way around.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyways, no, I don't. You know, that's another story.
You don't pine away for those days.
But we finished the tour. We did about 12 or 15 dates across America. Finished in L.A. And I remember one day going into Eric's or Roger's room, the manager's suite. We had pool tables.
Roger who?
Brought in Roger Forrester, Eric's manager.
Okay, right.
Who worked for Stigwoods. We bring in pool tables. We buy a pool table in each hotel. So we'd have a place to go and play pool.
Yeah.
And I walked into Eric's or Roger's room one day, and there was Eric and Jeff Beck playing pool.
Oh, wow.
And we just, you know, sat around. We all played pool, and it was just, you know.
Just hanging out.
But after we finished that tour.
Do you rub elbows or do you rub shoulders?
you just grease,
no, I know.
Grease palms.
Grease palms. I got it, got it.
Yeah, no, or you tune strings.
Yeah.
We finished that tour, and Roger said, well, I need you to stick around for another couple of days. We're going to go up to San Francisco. The band went, well, okay, what for? And he said, well, there's something going on up there. The band, Bob Dylan's band, up on Cripple Creek, and a group called The Band, Levon Helm and Rick Danko and a bunch of people.
Wow.
Who used to record here in L.A. at Big Pink. They were Bob Dylan's backup band.
Yeah.
Had been together for years. And they were breaking up. This was their last concert.
Oh, wow.
And they had invited artists. They invited dozens and dozens of artists, from Dr. John to Neil Diamond to Joni Mitchell to Eric Clapton to Etta James, to all sorts of people.
Goodness.
And so we flew up there. And
from?
We checked it from Los Angeles.
Okay.
We flew up there to do this.
Yeah.
Martin Scorsese was filming it.
Oh,
and
wow.
And it became The Last Waltz. That's what this was.
Oh, wow.
And I remember checking into the hotel, checking the band into the hotel, and I was standing there next to a guy. And the guy behind the desk wouldn't give him his key because the guy didn't know what to write in the form. You
for
know,
who's
check
checking in.
In? And I said, excuse me a minute. I said, this is Muddy Waters. I said, you need to let him...
Yeah.
Give him his key. And
oh,
he'll
wow.
I'll fill in the form. I didn't know Muddy, but I got to know him later on in life and tour with
that's
him, thank goodness.
You know, Passover comment.
But the guy didn't know who he was, and Muddy wasn't able,
yeah.
He didn't know what to put in. I'm sure he could write and all that, but he didn't know what model of car. He didn't have a car. You
yeah,
know,
yeah.
So he got up, and we checked in, and the show was great. I mean, it was just incredible to everybody there, all
wow.
in one place. They had a room called the Cockatoo Room in the middle of the dressing room. They had a dressing room that you wouldn't... Hundreds of people in it, celebrities, film stars, all sorts of people.
Yeah.
While the show was going on, the Cockatoo Room was all white, And you go in. I'd never went in. And there were white pillows all around.
Oh, wow.
And a glass table
yeah.
with white stuff all over it and the sound of sniffing through the speakers.
Oh, sure.
you know, it was just quite a food for days. You could eat anything. And the music, the whole concert lasted, I mean, it was probably about 12 or 14 hours worth
wow.
of music.
Wow. So it was like a festival-ish.
And all in one place.
Yeah.
Bill Graham produced it when he was still alive. And it was...
Wow.
That was the end of the tour. And the next day, everybody flew home. I went back to Tulsa with the Tulsa group, and Roger and Eric went back. And it was just, I mean, I couldn't believe what I'd just been through.
Wow. And so as far as you're aware right now, that's this gig done, and you don't quite know what's coming next, right?
Roger did say to me before I left, before he got on his plane to England, he said, "Have you ever been to England?" And I thought, well, I'd been wanting to go to England since I was 14.
Mm.
And he said, "Would you be interested in coming over in February and taking Jack Bruce out on the road?"
Nice.
And I said, "Well, I don't know." I said, "Yes." Yes. So I knew that there was something coming afterwards.
So
when we left, not only was I on a high of you know, this what a great experience.
Yeah.
And what a great experience the last waltz was, but I knew it wasn't over.
Right.
There was more coming, you know. And
well, let's just, because... From the little that I know, it really requires a super, like, an actual conversation dedicated to your tour managing life and, like, the things that you've, the places you've traveled, the bands you've been with and everything. But why don't you give everybody just a real quick rundown of some of the people that you've been a tour manager for and are on first-name basis with, let's just say.
Well, I mean, I toured with Eric on and off for from 76 to 82.
Yeah.
Through all of the Tulsa band, and then a couple of other bands he put together with Gary Brooker, Henry Spinetti, Albert Lee, well-known players. Gary Brooker was the singer for Procol Harum, Whiter Shade of Pale, and Salty Dog. I mean,
oh, wow.
It was incredible listening to him play live.
Yeah.
I roadied with JoJo Gunn.
Uh-huh.
We did a long tour with Black Hook Arkansas, Jay Giles, and JoJo Gunn.
Oh, wow.
That's when I decided that being a roadie guy, setting up amps or drums or pianos was the wrong career for me.
Right, right.
It's tough. It's a hard job. Then I went to work. I worked for Ozzy. I was Ozzy's tour manager. I went with Ozzy after the plane crash that killed Randy Rhoads, but... It was a wonderful experience. I planned Ozzy and Sharon's wedding. Actually, I took Eric's blood test when he married Patty because he was afraid of needles.
Gosh.
And he and I looked similar. And they used to put me out when to distract people at the back door. They would follow me into the limousine.
Thinking you're Eric Clapton.
Thinking I'm Eric. And then Eric's walking off the other way, getting in a taxi with Roger, and they'd head off. But the hospital didn't question me at all, and they took my blood so he could marry Patty.
Wow.
In Phoenix. I was with Ozzy and playing Ozzy and Sharon's wedding on Maui.
Wow.
After a world tour.
You're just blowing
tour,
everybody's minds here.
After a world tour, we did the US festivals that Steve Wozniak spent a fortune doing and maybe lost a fortune doing. But they were wonderful. I worked with Three Dog Night. I worked with, I'm sure I'll forget a bunch of people, but some of the ones that I enjoyed most, towards the latter part of my career, I worked with Firehouse in the 90s, who were a hair band that had a lot of power, love ballads. And
yeah.
They were great guys
nice.
And the music was good. And then I worked with a group from Sharon Osbourne that she managed called the Choir Boys. And I flew to her. She called me up one day and said, "What are you doing? Can you come to London tomorrow?
Do an impression.
What are you doing?" No, I don't.
You don't want to do that because you're on
a
first-name basis.
I can't cuss that bad.
That's right. Oh, well.
Sharon was great on the bus. It was fun traveling with her.
Nice.
As long as you were on her team, I wouldn't want to be not on her team,
yeah.
on the opposing team.
Yeah.
Anyways, we went... She said, "Can you come over and go to Switzerland and take over tour managing this band that I'm managing? And they've got some hit records. Their tour manager can't handle it."
Yeah.
So I said, yes. I flew to London to pick up some money to take with me to Switzerland for the get the thing started. And I saw a life-size cardboard cutout of these three guys, the six guys in the band. And
yeah.
They looked like Davy Jones pirates from Pirates of the Caribbean.
I mean, oh, wow.
They were long, sleazy, pirate-looking guys. And
wow.
I thought, oh, my gosh, what have I gotten myself into? And they turned out to be the greatest guys.
That's cool.
And the best music and the most fun.
Well, because that's all. I mean, it's part of their theatrics.
Well, it was just. It was.
You know, they didn't just dress around like pirates.
But they're still here. That was in the early 90s, and they're still playing.
Oh wow!
And they still look the same.
Wow.
I mean, that is them. That's how they're. But we did. I mean,
go see them.
But you know, we toured Europe. We toured South America. We toured Malaysia, Indonesia. Yeah. Thailand,
gosh.
You know, Japan, and all of that. And it was a blast, you know.
There's one other big band you're missing out on, though.
Oh, the Bee Gees.
That you took. Yeah, exactly.
I forget. Yeah,
well, the Bee Gees.
Well, people ask me, what was the best band or the most enjoyable band you ever worked for?
Yeah.
And it was the Bee Gees.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I mean,
their music is just fun to listen to.
Well, they were also managed by Stig Woods.
Yeah.
And their manager, Dick Ashby, met me through Roger and through Eric. They were going to go out on the Disco Stayin' Alive tour.
Yeah.
It became the Spirits Having Flown, that was the name of the tour, in 1979.
Wow.
And it was, I mean, it was...
So you're my age.
First class... What am I? I'm not your age.
You would be my age in 1979, not 29 years old.
Oh.
So you're going out with one of the biggest bands in the world.
Yeah,
at
29.
This moment.
The only other
and
tour
telling
was
them
bigger
where they
at
have
the time.
To go
the
next.
Only the only biggest tour at the time it had been McCartney.
Sure.
And Wings right before this.
Okay, sure.
And then the Bee Gees go out. They'd had Staying Alive, Saturday Night Fever, all of that was out. We had our own Boeing 730 jet. It
wow.
was Caesar's Palace's airplane. It was sofas and caviar every night. The music was fantastic. They had the Bonnaroo horns playing back up. So we had a 7 or 8-piece horn section every night.
Wow.
Shoko and had built a stage. That was a disco dance floor, multi-level, like 7 levels.
That's cool.
2 or 3 keyboard players, backup singers. It was just...
That was a massive tour.
It was incredible. And I got to recreate it, not that tour, but I got to work with the Bee Gees 10 years later. We did a world tour.
Yeah.
Once again, they called me up and said, we got to go out on tour. We're going to go out on tour. You got to come with us and all this. And
wow.
They were loud. The music was loud and powerful, and they were great. And we toured with families, which made it nicer.
Sure.
Mom and Dad came along, Barry's wife and the kids, Steven, who plays guitar with Barry now. Morris was fun to be around. Robin and his wife and kids, Morris's kids. All the band, and there were probably about 160 or 70 people.
Wow.
On the tour.
Gosh.
It was amazing.
And you're in charge of it all.
Well, I wasn't in charge of the three brothers. Dick took care of them.
Yeah.
Because they all had personal assistants. I took care of all of the band.
Yeah.
So there were about 20 of them and singers.
Yeah.
And we had a blind keyboard player, one of the keyboard players named George Bitzer, who's well known and a wonderful player. I left him once.
Oh,
at the
no.
hotel here in Los Angeles when we went to play Dodger Stadium, but we had to go back and get him.
Yeah.
But he made it, so.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
You kind of need a keyboard player.
Well, we were halfway to the stadium, and somebody said, where's George? And I went, oh, no.
I'm going to get fired now.
I left him in his room.
Well, thank you for coming on the show.
Well, it's my pleasure.
And please come back. You have to tell us all of these kinds of, like, because that's just a surface level of your touring industry.
Yeah, there's
days.
A lot. There's a lot. That's just kind of superficial.
Well, and
it also
kind of ties into you've got some products you could just mention real quick, just kind of all having to relate to your touring industry stories and stuff like that.
Well, we're working on one. Paul Dexter, Ken Malafant, and I have been working on Road Cases, which is about the live touring industry and how it came about and all the thousands of people that contributed to it, the crews, the bands, the truck drivers, the caterers, the the technicians that built it all. That's what Road Cases is all about. And I'm hoping that we get a chance to get it out there as a series. There's some other plans for it.
Absolutely.
And all of that. So I haven't packed it in. There's a lot of those guys that are still out there on the road.
Yeah.
Bugsy Hugdahl, who does Bon Jovi, he's been with them for 30 years.
Yeah.
Omar Abdurrahman. Some of these people are just doing some great stuff. So, yeah, no, this isn't the end. I'll be back.
Good.
If you can pay more.
Twitter at Earthship Radio, or online at EnterTheElfTree.com. Or else I will find you.